Hi, I'm Richard Burnaby, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Lens, where I speak with inspiring people from all over the world about photography, the arts, travel, conservation, entrepreneurship, and creative culture. In this episode, I'm joined by National Geographic photographer Matthew Pelle. Matthew is a French photographer who has traveled the world working with National Geographic and other publications as well, like Time magazine. He's been a bit of a nomad, living in Turkey, Pakistan, the U.S., currently in Portugal, and always with his family traveling with him. Matthew has focused his photographic efforts on regions that are misrepresented or underrepresented, and he's passionately committed to issues relating to diminishing cultures and the environment. Matthew is a recipient of numerous awards, and he's published several books of his work, and his fine art images have been exhibited in galleries worldwide, including museums. He is regularly commissioned for commercial campaigns, photo workshops, and speaking engagements around the world. Matthew's website is PeleyPhoto.com. Pele is spelled P-A-L-E-Y, PeleyPhoto.com. Instagram, where he has 500,000 followers, is at PeleyPhoto. And my conversation with Matthew is coming up right after this short message from one of our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Luminar Neo. Friends, let me tell you about this incredibly powerful photo editor that I love called Luminar Neo. Powered by AI technologies, Luminar Neo streamlines the editing process and provides everything you could possibly need to get photos that will look amazing on the screen and in print. Luminar Neo was designed for both hobbyists and pros and includes cutting-edge editing tools all in one intuitive and easy-to-use app. It uses generative AI to intelligently analyze your photos and erase distracting elements in your compositions, add realistic objects that seamlessly blend into the background, or expand the frame in any direction. If that's your thing, of course. If not, it's still one of the most powerful photo editors when keeping your images natural and realistic as well. How you use it is totally up to you. Luminar Neo has all the features you need to enhance your images with precision and ease, and again, I can't stress enough how incredibly easy it is to use and how powerful this editor is. You can use Luminar Neo as a standalone app on your PC or Mac computer, or, if you're like me, as a plugin for Adobe Lightroom or Photoshop, so you can keep your existing workflow. Learn more about Luminar Neo and how it can amplify your creative vision for your photos by visiting skylum.com. That's skylum.com. Hello, Matthew. Welcome to the podcast. Glad you could join me.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You've been a bit of a nomad through most of your career and most of your adult life, I guess, for that matter. We'll talk about some of that later and your photography, obviously.
Yes.
But right now, you're on your farm in Portugal, just southeast of Lisbon. Would you like to talk about why you've been there for the past several years and what you've been doing?
Why am I here? I don't know why I'm here. I mean, I always end up kind of out of serendipity or just accidents of life. We wanted to be a bit closer to Asia. My wife is German, I'm French, so we didn't want to be in either of these countries. After living abroad for too long, I would have just gone absolutely mental living home. I love my homeland, but living there, it's just out of the question now. And so Portugal was, after much thinking and trying out, before coming to Portugal, we were living in Turkey for 7 years, near Izmir. And Portugal was a place we decided to sell because my wife has a retreat idea in mind that she's been working on, and Turkey was too unstable to start on that. And Portugal seems like the right kind of quiet, quiet enough place for us to settle. And then we eventually found the land. And then shortly after I found the land, COVID hit. And we had bought the land more because of its location, which is 1 foot inside a small medieval village and 1 foot in nature inside Arabida. And so COVID hits and I'm just about going, crazy sitting on my computer. or, you know, just steering crazy. Thinking, what can I do?
And then tragedy struck in July of 2022.
Well, there was a fire, a devastating fire inside Arabida that burned our land to a degree quite bad. It was really unexpected, and nobody in the village for generation can remember any fire around here. It's not specific. The areas that get hit by fire in Portugal are many, and they're mostly inland because there's a lot of eucalyptus monoculture, and that creates a lot of dryness in the soil, and it's very flammable. So Portugal has big issues with fire, but not where we live. And so it was just a freak kind of, you know, freak fire that was started voluntarily, but also there was a specific wind, south wind that day, there's never south wind in summer. It's always north. I mean, south wind is a winter wind. So it was just really unusual. And it was quite an experience, quite traumatic, maybe not as much for me as for my kids, maybe.
So I'm going to shift gears a bit here to your work. Mm-hmm. Mark Twain once said, travel is fatal to prejudice and narrow-mindedness. Mm-hmm. What does that quote mean to you and your photography work?
Well, it's very close to me, that quote. I love that quote. Well, I just it goes back to me as an aspiring photographer, volunteering, teaching in the mountains of Pakistan in 1999, 2000, 2001. I was trekking in the Karakoram on September 11th. And soon enough, I got a hold. I was really aspiring photographer. I was just starting to work with a couple of NGOs. I had gotten one job for National Geographic Adventure in Bhutan. It was just slowly bubbling up. And I was based in Pakistan. And I was slowly falling in love with this place. The complexity of that place is just magnificent. And to this day, it's my favorite country to keep on exploring. And so September 11 happens, and I don't know who it was, Time or Newsweek, you know, no finding out that I'm there on the ground, asked me to go and photographed in Islamabad. That must have been late September. There were demonstration, people burning the American flag, blah, 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 you know the drill. And so I'm proposed at this stage, for me, a substantial amount of money to go and photograph these things that are so hot. This is hot news, right? So hot that to me, they're not fairly completely well understood at this stage. It's not possible, being that close to the event, to properly understand it. I realized quickly that it wasn't for me, and that I wanted to tell the other side of the story. And to this day, yeah, any stories that will allow me to, in some degrees, to break stereotypes and narrow-mindedness, I would get genuinely excited about it. You know, this is this little small percentage that is so revealing, though, to me. It's not because it's a majority that it is what it is. And so I've always really be excited. My ideal assignment is going to be breaking stereotype and on foot, ideally on foot, because I've always loved all my most incredible memories happen slowly on foot with the what happens in your brain when you walk, as opposed to being parachuted in a place or with your 4x4. So that's my kind of. If you have any to propose me, Richard, I'm your man.
And how has that approach helped you when it comes to working in parts of the world like remote areas of Pakistan, Afghanistan, which suffer from misconceptions and being prejudged and underrepresented in the world's eyes?
For me, I don't know how it has helped me. Initially, it didn't, because initially it was the opposite of helping me, because I was not going with the grain in terms of telling what the world wanted to hear at this stage. I would have gotten a lot more assignment if I had then had been in Pakistan, going down the street, photographing these, riots or whatever, and then saying, I'm going to Kabul, I'm going to photograph what's happening in Afghanistan. I would have been droning in work. They didn't help me initially.
So this is right after 9/11, and you're in Pakistan, and you're turning down stories and assignments, the dominant narrative, you know, covering the protests and that sort of thing, because you want to cover the alternative or the underrepresented stories and narratives.
Yeah, I've always stuck to that, and that has helped me tremendously.
Maybe that's because everybody's chasing the same story.
It was tempting. It was very tempting. But as you always have to check with your heart if you're into what you're doing. And I've gone through phases in my life where I would pitch stories where my mind, my head, was thinking much more than my heart. And it would be interesting, but it would be also very frustrating at times. So it's the right balance between head and heart in terms of being then the best photographer, best information giver, true information giver. Never true, of course, it's your opinion, but being really like involved to a degree that you understand the second, third layer of understanding in a situation. You know, that's very important.
Well, since people and culture are your primary photography subjects, what skills and tools do you use to help connect with those people and allow you to make those meaningful images of people with an entirely different culture than yours? I mean, you grew up in Europe and in France. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in, are there any specific skills that you have or any tools that you use to help connect with those people?
Well, there are multiple, and I think that's the core of being a photographer, also being able to go down on your knees, you know, so to speak, in terms of being at people's level when it's necessary. Well, languages is one big thing. I speak 8 languages now, kind of. I don't know.
8 languages.
Yeah. I speak 8
Which languages are they?
So French, German, English. My wife being German, I learned German in school. French, German, English, my 3 kind of core languages that I, you know, speak very good. And then I was really fortunate to learn Urdu when I was living in Pakistan. When I say learn, I speak like really broken, but I can make people laugh. I can be understood completely. The grammar is always my weakness. I don't want to spend too much time on grammar because I'm not going to write a book or whatever. It's all about communication and being able to. So Urdu is a compound language. It has Arabic in it. It has Persian. It has Sanskrit. So when you're learning Urdu, you're learning a bunch of other languages at the same time. And that, so Urdu, Hindi, I speak, they're kind of the same. That allowed me to make the jump to Turkish when I lived in Turkey, because Turkish has also Arabic and Persian in it. So I could like already, I had like maybe, I don't know, 100 words. It's just a little step up to give you confidence. Wahi, which is a very interesting language that is spoken about by about 100,000 people. I speak good enough. It's a minority language that is not written, unwritten language. It's spoken by the mountain people of North Pakistan, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, and a bit in China, in Xinjiang, Western China. Portuguese now I've learned. Farsi, Persian, I've learned over the years living in Tajikistan, working in Afghanistan also, kind of. How many is that? You know, I've learned when I
crossed count.
When I walked across Mongolia in my early years, I did learn a bit of Mongolian. I have a thing for language. I just get a kick out of it. I just really get a kick out of it. Yeah.
You don't have to speak it perfectly, but even if you just know a few words, it shows some modesty on your part. And I think you've called it a gesture of respect.
Yeah. For me, it's 100% that it is. And so respect is not necessarily, you know, it's all these unwritten rules. Because if you're going to go to Pakistan and want to read the warning in the Lonely Planet or whatever, you know, or like in Bhutan or, you know, don't touch the kid's head, Buddhism, whatever. It's all very incredibly flexible upon the person, how you present yourself. I'm always true to myself. And I'm like now. I can be very forceful. I like to talk. I like to, you know, live well. I like to, I know when to shut up. I would say one important thing among languages, one thing is body, gesture. Body language is so important. Being able to analyze the body language, you know, I would change literally when I'm in Pakistan. I'm a different person.
In what way?
Well, in Pakistan, they can be very, like, they are very close, like as in body hugging, and they can be very close. You can hold guy's hand, and I love to explore that. I will be very forceful in terms of calling out people, and you would be like, you would know, you would take this out of context in France. I would be like the rude guy, you know, like who doesn't like, because again, it's a question of context. Where are you now? You talk to Jack Herter, I'm in the depth of the mountain. There's this raw kind of interaction. First time I really discovered that was in Mongolia. In 98, I kind of crossed a good part of Mongolia on foot, hitchhiking with my girlfriend, now wife. And we would be judging the way to our eye, Mongolian were rude in terms of they have no sense of intimacy. We'd be sleeping in our tent, you know, and a guy on horseback at 6 a.m. as the sun rose would pass by and just zip open the tent, stick his head in there to see what's going on. Because in Mongolia, in Mongolia, it's considered rude to knock on a door, technically. Because if I knock on you, Richard, you're sitting in your yurt and I arrive and I say, can I come in? And you're thinking, Matthew, that's really rude. You are questioning my capacity to host you? Why are you doing that? That's not cool, man. So you see how everything can be shifted? And that is, yes. That was a big key moment for me to understand that. And one of my, another quote, you talked about Mark Twain before, but I don't know who said that, but the expression of hold your beliefs lightly. I really take that very close to heart, like hold your beliefs lightly. Whenever people are very dead determined on things and religion does that, I'm like, sorry. It's not good.
It's dangerous.
That's yeah. Also one thing. I just did a story for National Geographic around religion, and I loved because it was also looking at ways that religion affect each other. You know, as in we all borrow from each other. Of course we do, and nothing is really like, you know, is core. Or that's my belief. You know, I'll get in trouble maybe for saying that, but and also minimal equipment. I have a small bag that I've had for years. It's not here. I've only had that bag. It's a small sling bag that I hold, get here with one camera, one lens. That's it. And I see some colleagues, you know, taking pictures at the airport with a mountain of stuff, and I'm like, oh my god, I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, so, I was going to ask you about that bag because you've actually said this bag is really important to you, and you actually. Yeah. Configure your camera gear to fit the bag instead of getting the bag to fit your camera gear, which is unusual, but you have a reason for this.
Well, where is it? Where's my bag? I just moved house, so things are a little bit, but you know what I mean. It's an old Tamrac. They stopped doing it. It's called the Half Moon Tamrac bag. And it's meant to go around your waist, but soon enough, I put it around my chest. And I've worried for so long that my right rib is actually a little bit collapsed because of the weight on the right side.
Wait, it's Half Moon Camera Bag.
Yeah, it's called Half Moon Tamrac. It's a sling, yeah. Sling bag that I carry like that, so on my left shoulder. And the thing is, that bag is never closed. And I always, like, whenever people pick it up, they always want to close the zipper. I'm like, no, don't close that zipper. That zipper stays always open. So look, I'm like this. I go in on my chest. I leave the camera. I take a picture. I put it back in. So when I enter a space, I don't have my camera around my neck. I don't have to sling a backpack to open it, to reveal stuff. I want to be low impact, not impress people. I want to be the opposite of impressing. The only way I want to impress people is by bringing their laughter and joy. And that's how I want to impress people. Not with my gear. I don't want to talk about gear. I'm bored talking about gear and whatever. This is not the point. The photography is so much more and so much more glorious than just f-stop and what camera are you using. You know, of course, there is thing about softness in the light, how it can capture it, that, you know, allow, like recently I've gone back to a medium format, shooting medium format digital. And really, like, I love it because it gives me back the softness that I used to have with negative when I was scanning my negative. Now it's like, what, 15 years ago. So low impact. I'm big enough. I'm tall, you know, I'm big enough. I'm loud enough. I'm white enough when I'm ending up in these remote places that I want to reduce everything.
Okay, so getting into that, how important is cultural immersion for the type of photography you do? Is it possible to create your images without immersion by just standing on the outside looking in?
No. Well, first of all, no. No. You got to be in fully. There's no way to be fully immerse yourself. You're going to be coming up with your own truth about this. And there's nothing, I never could agree with this. It's a dialogue of the past, you know, these people like not recropping their images, or like, you know, not wanting to interfere, not wanting to talk to them, to people around there, because they might affect the situation. No, of course, sometimes, I mean, you know, eyes can talk. Eyes talk more than anything. Eyes talk more than your mouth. When you enter a room and you see something beautiful and in a corner of the house, the worst thing you can do is starting to look at it, because your eyes would be like amazing. People might know you want to take pictures and stuff. You will interfere not knowing this. You will interfere with that situation. You got to ignore it and look opposite. It's psychology. Photography psychology. That's all that it is. But immersion is essential. I would not be a photographer anymore if I was told that I could not immerse myself in what I'm seeing, because I'm going into that situation to learn. And if I don't immerse myself, I don't learn. I only care about learning. I don't care about taking pictures. I only care about learning if I'm going to grow out of this. I don't care about pictures secondary, way secondary to me.
That's a good approach.
The beauty and the design is something there already. I'm just there to just try not to meddle with it. And if I don't, then I'll take a strong image. There is so much to more to it. Of course, now I have so many ways to anticipate when I'm being told something. I can understand if it's really meant like this or like that. This is years and years of experience in terms of putting myself in the right situation. That's very important. But that's not being a photographer. That's something else, you know. And that's, again, psychology, understanding how to put yourself in the right situation that fits, that hits the right line. In the assignment, you know, that's the sweet line between really sticking to the story, a level of poetry, depth, second layer. If you're going to have a beautiful picture and you look at it, Richard, and you make up your idea about what you're seeing and you read the caption, and I just broke your stereotype about, like we all do, huh? Mm-hmm. About what you thought you were looking at, and you have to rethink what you just looked at. That is me sharing what I learned, because I had the luck to go there. And so it's all about learning for me. Yeah.
That's a good answer. What do you hope to express or communicate to your audiences? Is there a goal or a purpose in mind? Or is it just, like you said, sharing what you've learned with your viewers and hoping to break that stereotype or what their preconceived ideas are?
Mm. I think that's it. That's really that. And it's a big job, because you are faced with a machine that that is constantly rebuilding these stereotypes and re-strengthening them. And even when I have this evidence, people are still in doubt. So there's a lot to do. Now we have the added, the added tools of video, for example, in social media, or things that will help to, would be an additional tool to break stereotypes. So I'll explore that as well. It's kind of overwhelming now, the amount of stuff that needs to be done on assignment now. But when I started, of course, I was shooting a film I would send my best, would scan that, that would be printed. Now, as you know, the job as photographer has gotten so much more than just taking pictures. So that's exciting. That's challenging. It's a constant source of stress, for sure. Good stress, though.
We'll be right back to the show after this short message. This episode is brought to you by Case Filters. Look, I travel the world with my camera, and I can use any photography filter I like. And trust me, I've tried them all. But I only trust my photos to Case Filters. That's Case with a K, K-A-S-E. Why? Well, they're made with premium materials, HD optical glass, shockproof, no color cast, unlike some filters I've used in the past. round and square filter designs, magnetic systems, filter holders, adapters, step-up rings, everything I need so I never miss a moment. And now my listeners can get 10% off the Case Filters Amazon page when they visit beyondthelens.fm/case and use coupon code Burnaby10. Check it out, beyondthelens.fm/case. Use Burnaby10 at checkout for 10% off your Case Filters Amazon order. Case Filters, capture with confidence. So let's talk about the region of Central Asia called the Pamir, which I guess a mountainous area in Pakistan, Afghanistan on the border, if I'm correct.
Yeah, not really in Pakistan. Actually, there's a tiny bit
of
the right Pakistan. Side of a valley called Chapursan Valley, where technically it's the Pamir meeting with the Hindu Kush and the Karakoram.
Talk about this area and what it means to you as a person and as a photographer, because you spend a lot of time there.
Yeah, I mean, it was my mother, I would say, almost as like, you know, if photography, I had a father and a mother, two professional mother and father, this would be my mother and father. They were kind of, this mountain were the ones to teach me the people in the mountains, the landscape, the exposure I took on so many expeditions in winter, in summer, in winter especially, quite a few, where you are completely exposed. And if something happened, you better have a solution for yourself. Pamir, even the word is just to me now, just the word Pamir is just something magical. It is something very, just the word already is enough for me in terms of, I have the faculty now to go there if I want to, if I close my eyes now. It is a place of that is incredibly raw and real and magical, and it's, for me, it's heaven. It's heaven. It's the version of heaven. It is also hell to a lot of people, and I don't want to be romantic. And I've been accused sometimes of being very romantic with my images, which I don't agree with, because I just happened to be there at a time where everywhere you were looking, it was this very romantic idea of the people living at the end of the world.
When you say romantic, do you mean like idealized, like showing the best?
Yeah, yeah.
And leaving out the worst.
Yeah. And that never, never. Like, why are you kicking out all the... No, I won't. Once the walkie-talkie showed up before the phone came in, I would see a walkie-talkie. I would be all over it. That is so cool. Look at this contrast. You know, how can I include that in my image and bring the contrast? I'm not going to be like, oh, sorry, I'm going to reframe that. I don't want to see the guy, you know, because of it doesn't look, romantic enough. So the Pamir, I don't know. It's just, that is a tough question. You need to have slept there and walk for days on it. You know, you walk for days on end at high altitude. Your brain goes into a space that is... So that has so much clarity, and suddenly you see your life and where you want to go. You see your death. You see you have just a vision that comes with days and days of exhaustion and of being food-wise also, like kind of you go into a fasting kind of retreat through this mountain that have nothing to divert you. It's just this mineral desert. You'll meet the occasional herders, and so wahi herders. So I'll engage in wahi and just, you know, it's just this, it's just impossible, Richard. It's impossible to really express the level of rawness and purity I experience there every time I go there. And mountains do that to me. I still have to, like, one of my other dreams I haven't done is to cross the Atlantic or like be at sea for weeks and weeks on end to see what it does. But it is like that, being just lost in space.
Isolated.
Isolated. I've been in isolated place that feels though that they can sustain life. This is a place that is so isolated and also feels that it's so deprived also of life, that it is like walking on the moon, really, it's a cliche to say that, but it does affect your brain, and you reach that place of clarity that makes you get, I think it's, that's it. You get younger. You come out of this experience, you're just 10 years younger every time. So of course I want to go every once in a while. It's the elixir of youth, right? For me, this is the elixir of youth. And I think many people will share that. The fountain of youth. Yeah, that's it. The Pamir is the fountain of youth.
Do you have a specific story or memory of your time in the Pamir that really represents what the Pamir is all about?
There was stories that scared me.
One situation where you were scared. What scared you?
One situation where I was scared. Well, it was all in my head. Yeah. You create the reality you want to put in your head. That is where reality sits, your own reality.
Of course.
And we did something. It's long. All these stories are quite long. So I'll have to shortcut it a bit. But we were going to deliver letters to this, from this exiled community of Kyrgyz nomads in Turkey. They had been there for 25 years. They had left Afghanistan when the Russians showed up. And a good part of this community was still up in the Pamir. So it's about, you fly tomorrow, you drive for 1 week, you get off the vehicle, you prepare like a caravan of yaks or whatever, you walk another week, and finally you reach there. It's 2 weeks to get there. When I would go on assignment for National Geographic, I went a few times, I would go for 5 weeks out. And out of these 5 weeks, I would get maybe 10 days to actually shoot the story. The rest was getting in and out. That's how remote it is. And so we were going to go to Afghanistan in summer 2005 to deliver the letters from this exact community in Turkey to this to their brothers and sisters they hadn't seen for 25 years. We were postmen, my wife and I. And so we got a donkey. We're like big donkey fans. About a donkey and headed out. And the problem we were facing is that we were going to go into Afghanistan and enter Pakistan into an area where you can technically not enter. So illegal entry point into Pakistan. So before we did that, we did meet with the prime minister, blah, 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 in Islamabad, trying to explain. They were like, what? We ought to open maps, blah, blah, blah. My picture had just been on the cover of Time magazine. So I was like, you know, like I can take pictures.
I did this. You know?
Yeah. So anyway, we ended up walking in this very remote area. And as we approached, after days and days, it's been maybe 20 days that we walk. I was like skinny. I mean, we had no more food. It was, we are approaching the exit high pass over 5,000 meters, about 14,000 feet into Pakistan. And a day or two before, we pass a border guard, Afghan border guard, and we know what we're doing going into this valley. If he would think a bit, he would know very well. We're heading up this. It's just a one-way valley. They're heading into Pakistan. That means they're exiting Afghanistan without an exit stamp. At this stage there's no exit stamp for like weeks. So, you know, either it's like, okay. So I became really psychotic. I'm like, this guy got to know. They were on horseback. They're going to come and get us. They're going to bring us into jail back to Ishkashim or, you know, down in the Wakhan corridor. And our whole plan will fall through. And it became very difficult to sleep at night. I was very worried. So that was quite scary. Actually, all my horror stories link back to administration and this kind of stuff, because I was always being very attracted to try new routes that meant often being in border areas between Afghanistan, Pakistan, Tajikistan, China, all this area there. There's amazing potential of exploration, but it's always right on the border, stepping into another country, looping back in. If you get caught, blah, blah, blah. These borders have been drawn kind of randomly on both sides of the valleys. You have the exact same people that are related, but big powers, in this case, Tsarist Russia or the British Empire, decided to draw a line there. And then China came in and blah, blah, blah. So it's very interesting and intricate part of the world. But yeah, all the administration, all the visa stories I have that created so much stress. Once also I got threatened at knife point in amongst the Kyrgyz. It's sad though that I tell you these stories because 99.9% of the time it's just been glorious hospitality and just really kindness. But those little incident always revealed something that I had not understood, where I was ignorant to understand and I was doing a faux pas in terms of culture without realizing it. You know, even with my language skill and stuff, you were still, I wasn't really like, huh, this guy is not a Wahi. He's a Pathan. So therefore he like has an influence on the way people behave there. And I'm playing in it and they need to show face and not let me do that. Although the day before yesterday, they let me do it. Stories like that. And then I got in trouble and it shakes you because it shakes you. You're far away from family, from any cultural grasp of being able to talk to a friend about it. You're left with these worries and sleeping in that mud house or in that tent. And it's, you know, I have a good story. Donkey story. I have lots of donkey stories.
I'm always open for a donkey story.
It was day two on our first big expedition in summer. After that, I went in winter and our the second donkey. I was always, my nickname in Pakistan is Kharab Bakri. It means bad goat because I would always decide to shortcut through the stupid loop going up. Come on, let's go straight in. Bad goat. Kharab means bad. Bad goat. Bad goat. Bad, yeah, goat. I'm a bad goat. And I would always just head up straight. And I thought I could do the same with donkeys. Not a good idea. Because as it turned out, if you have somebody leading up and the donkey is really loaded and it becomes too steep, the donkey front feet, hoofs or whatever cannot grasp anymore. And the donkey just fall backward. And so this happened. I was behind and Marelle, my wife, was, going through that shortcut. And the donkey's front leg started to go up. And I had to, I was going to get crashed by the donkey. I had to move out. And I saw the donkeys with absolutely everything we owned. I was wearing shalwar kameez. I didn't have my passport, didn't have my camera. Everything was in the donkey. And that donkey went down tumbling towards the river, the Wahan River down below. And thank God there was a little terrace below the river where it kind of smashed. And with like scattered luggages around. And as I rushed down the steep slope, I thought the only thing I have to finish up this poor donkey that for sure is going to die is my Swiss knife. That's going to be rough. You know, that's not going to be fun. And as I approached, the donkey was just knocked out, like really like a boxer that had been knocked out and kind of still had eyes up. And just like after 5-10 minutes, we're like, we unloaded quickly, we kind of pampered it, brought water, whatever. And the donkey just came back up and then we walked with it for like a month all the way into Pakistan.
These places, why is it so difficult to sell positive stories about areas like this compared to dramatic stories?
Well, I think it's difficult to sell positive stories point blank because people want drama. That's just human nature. Are you going to read something with a headline that is all promising and happy? Not really. You're going to be drawn to the drama, because you want that. It must be physically explainable in terms of chemicals or what happens in your brain. You need that. You know, we used to hunt and get in serious trouble with like being charged by elephant or whatever. And maybe when we see a headline, we get a little bit of that excitement of the elephant charging us. And you're not going to read the happy headline. So it's always been difficult. I don't necessarily, I like stories that have contrast and issues within it. Especially communities that are, I love stories that are, dealing with people that are being pushed away by mainstream society. That's how I fell in love with these pilgrim Sufis. And I've been, walking and getting really close to this. They are renegades. They are like looked down upon by mainstream society in Pakistan. That's now in South Pakistan, in Sindh and Balochistan, a place I absolutely love. And I've learned to discover the last 5-6 years. these are positive stories of people that are incredibly enlightened and excited and happy, and that have nothing, and that have so much to teach us with their way they deal with life without stress. And me, I'm quite good with this, but I would be with them. I'm like, you guys are nuts. We have no water. It's 45 degrees Celsius. We have to walk. Dude, when we need water, we'll find it. You need to chill, you know? And I'm like, oh, you know, I'm good. And sure enough, leaving it in the hand of fate often, really often works. And we worry 95% of the time for nothing. We do, truthfully do, in the modern world or, you know, wherever. And I've learned to really gain perspective on being anxious. There's a lot of anxiety, so much anxiety that is useless, completely useless.
Absolutely. Can you talk about the concept of home and what does it mean to you personally as someone who has moved through the world most of your adult life in your work? I mean, what is home to you?
Well, now it's quite different the last few years. The concept of home has really changed since I planted trees. It's really, really meaningful to plant trees. And you can't walk away from a place where you have planted trees. If you plant a house, it's different. If you build a house, it's also emotionally attached to it, but it's different. I remember we lived 7 years in Turkey, and I did work on like building the entire garden. We did like somewhere. We were living in a village called Alaçatı near Izmir. And I planted 3 olive trees in the street. As in Turkey, it's okay to go in the cobble street, pick out the cobblestones, make a hole and plant a tree. I mean, you would do that in France or whatever. You'd get a lot of people be like, what the hell are you doing? In Turkey, my neighbor would pass and be like, great, man, you're really improving the place. And we left. We left. And years after, I wasn't really asking about the house. I wanted my friends that would pass by where we live to take pictures of the trees. I wanted to see how they looked. Because trees will only glorify with time and become more and more beautiful. A house is just a downhill from the moment. It's like a car, you know what I mean? A house is just downhill. So nature, like now the concept of home for me, having planted thousands of trees here, I know 100% that for the rest of my life, I will be deeply attached to this place here, and I could call it home because of that, because of the roots. That's why it's called having roots. I think it's really just because you
having roots
is really linked to, for me, planting things. These are my babies. These are humans. I mean, for me, beings. Sorry, not humans. These are beings that I've connected to. And that I cherish and I see blossoming as I do with my kids as well. It was a topic that really disturbed me. That's the right word, disturbed me for a while, because nowadays with digital also the nomadic photographer, suddenly you can live anywhere. And of course, the grass is always greener on the other side. And I lived 9 years in Hong Kong in a little village called Sheko where I could go surf. I had an amazing community around us. I can't drive to the next country. I have to take a plane. I'm fed up with, you know, like there's always something. In Turkey, it was great. Oh, but this, you know. I have to say that right now, if you ask me, I really feel rooted here and very strongly at home in Portugal. It really hits a lot of the stuff we are looking for. It's a fascinating topic. And I know many of my colleagues are dealing with the same issue because
wherever you feel connected, that is home. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, in ways, I have many homes. I'm Pakistan, I'm home. I'm home in Pakistan, 100%. There's also when you have a family, you know, then home becomes the place where you can have good schools and stuff. That's also why this is another thing. Homeschooling, self-directed learning for my kids has been a big philosophical decision to us as a family. And they've been doing that. Now my kids have been doing that for 5 years. So we're not really linked to, I think every every step of the way, if you can live without the necessity for institutions, you can do it. So growing your own food, for example, you will learn so much in the process of doing that. It's something that I always strive to, like, why do we need to just be born and automatically go into that pattern? Why don't we think of this automatic situation we put all of us into? Why don't we think those carefully and see if it works, or if there are alternative solutions? Yeah, alternative solution. And now also with the internet, that has, in terms of self-directed learning, the knowledge is just there. I mean, the knowledge is just there.
It's anything there. Anything you want to learn, you can get on the internet, honestly.
Anything. If you have a critical mind and know how to search for things properly, anything you want to learn. And it is very exciting. I've learned so many things just sitting with my kids when they had questions, and we spent hours learning about so much stuff. The other day I was listening to reggae. I don't listen, but the guy was talking about Babylon. And my kids are like, what is Babylon? I'm like, I think I got a clue, but let's do a class on Babylon, you know? So then we are in Mesopotamia and learning about all this stuff. And it was amazing, you know? So all this stuff is
you just have to have a curious mind. You have to have a curious mind and want to learn. Mm-hmm. And you can learn anything you like. You could be a self-educated person if you like.
Yeah, curiosity is also, we didn't touch on that, but it is something from education and culture with my family, for my parents, I've always questioned my environment and be endlessly curious about everything that's around me. I think it's so, so important in photography, right?
So I have a feeling you're going to answer about five or six different things on this question, but what are you inspired by? What really inspires you?
Well, I went through different period of my life where inspiration would come from different means. Music, initially music. I did study music. I was not sure if I was going to be a photographer or I wanted to get into music. I did study business or whatever, because again, society was like telling me, you can't think too much about what you should do. You should just do it, you know, and that's not right. I ended up going the wrong way for about 4 years of my life. And going the wrong way is very good, because at least you become very determined into what you don't want to do. And that gives me the strength and the impulse and the energy to go into photography. When I was about 23, I started to want to go that direction, which is, you know, a bit late, I guess. I don't know. Inspiration is just last night, sitting at the cafe, practicing my Portuguese with Maria, who is 77 years old and who I have seen for 3 years, 3-4 years. It's the bar right above our land. And when I'm fed up in summer, we don't have fridge on the land. We live off grid, more or less, when we're on the land. We have a small house that I'm in now that is right above the land. If I look at the window, I can see the land. But I'm sitting with Maria, and she tell me that before she was a Paliavu. And I was like, what the hell is Paliavu? And I look in my phone, and a clown. I say, what? She's like, yeah, I used to be a clown for 13 years. I was cruising all around Portugal and Angola. And you know, I was working in a circus. That's how I ended up here in this village in Pamela, because my husband came touring with circus. And then I fell in love with Pamela. And that's just, you know, all these little things, the amount of, we all have miraculous stories. I'm sure you do too, of your life, and finding this entry point by chit-chatting around a beer or whatever to these miracles that everybody has is an endless and incredibly creative way to get inspired.
Folks, please check out Matthew's website, PeleFoto.com. Am I pronouncing that right, Pele?
Yeah, Pele Photo. Pele is quite English. Pele. We don't know where it comes from. Yeah, PaleyPhoto. Yeah, Pele Photo.
So it's PaleY, PeleFoto.com, and Instagram @PeleFoto. You've got 500,000 followers
Yeah. And yeah, it's strange. What's annoying with social media is you need this regularity, which I don't have because I hate routine.
You don't have to forget about this.
Well, apparently, if you want to climb the numbers, you know, Richard, because otherwise you're nobody.
You've done something right. You've done something right on many different levels.
Yeah. Thank you.
Matthew, thanks so much for spending time with me.
Thanks, Richard.
It's been a really fun conversation.
Thank you. Be safe out there. My pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Beyond the Lens with me, Richard Burnaby. Thanks to Matthew Paley for taking the time to join me in this fun and inspiring conversation. And thanks to you, of course, for listening. You can tweet me at BurnabyPhoto with any comments or feedback. I love getting feedback on the show at TwitterX. And if you did enjoy the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, rating on Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'd love to hear what you think about the show and what you'd like to see from Beyond the Lens in the future. You can sign up to receive an email when a new episode drops at our website, beyondthelens.fm, and look for the link to the Richard Burnaby Substack. Here's the truth, adventure, and passion. See you next time.